Most grieving widows seek comfort. Karina Cooper sought an audience. 2 weeks after her husband's mysterious death, Karina was live on local morning television, smiling through tears, telling the world how she forgave the man who took her soulmate. But behind her polished poise and tearful storytelling lay a far darker truth. The man she claimed had vanished into the night hadn't vanished at all. He was murdered in cold blood, shot execution style, in the couple's garage. And when detectives pulled the security footage, the killer's silhouette looked eerily familiar. It wasn't the killer's identity that stunned the town. It was what Karina said. And how she said it. Because Karina's interviews, her social media posts, even the police statements she gave, they didn't add up. Her words became weapons. And investigators would soon realize they were chasing not just a murder, but a master manipulator who may have orchestrated her husband's death with chilling precision. What happens when grief becomes a performance? And how do you convict someone who only used their words? So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. The Perfect Wife. The Perfect Lie. Karina Cooper had always known how to hold a room. Whether it was a charity gala, a book signing for her latest children's novel, or the brightly lit stage of a morning television set, she carried herself with an effortless grace. Her public persona was magnetic, equal parts sophistication and warmth, tinged with just enough vulnerability to seem real. That's what people liked about her. That's what made them trust her. And it's also what made them believe her, when they shouldn't have. She'd married Ryan Cooper in 2015, a soft-spoken civil engineer with a quiet sense of humor and a deep love for building things. Bridges, houses, relationships. Together, they were a vision of upper-middle-class success in the suburbs of Charleston, South Carolina. Their two-story colonial home was the envy of their gated neighborhood. Their golden retriever, Samson, was the neighborhood's unofficial mascot. On Instagram, they were that couple. Tastefully filtered, always smiling. But behind the curated moments and polished appearances, something dark was brewing. And on the night of March 12, 2023, it boiled over. The call. The 911 dispatcher's voice was calm but urgent. 911, what's your emergency? A woman's breathless voice crackled through the speaker. My husband, oh my God, he's been shot. There's so much blood. Mom, are you safe? Are you in the house now? No. I just got home. He's in the garage. I didn't go in. I saw him lying there. I think he's dead. It was 11:43 p.m. When paramedics arrived at the Cooper home 7 minutes later, they found Karina in a silk blouse, barefoot on the driveway, shaking and crying, but not hysterical. One officer noted how clean she looked. No blood on her hands, no signs of distress other than the practiced weeping. Ryan's body was found slumped near the driver's side door of his Tesla Model X. 2 gunshot wounds, both behind the left ear. There were no signs of struggle, no shell casings nearby, no blood trail leading in or out of the garage. Execution style. A city in shock. By morning, the story had already hit the local news. Charleston husband shot dead in garage, wife finds body. The community reeled. This wasn't supposed to happen here, not in this part of town, not to people like the Coopers. Karina appeared on the morning news just 2 days later, dressed in a soft gray sweater, makeup tastefully done, eyes glassy but alert. She sat down with Channel 7's Marsha Delaney. Her voice quivered at all the right moments. Ryan was my best friend, she said, clasping her hands tightly. He was the love of my life. And I forgive whoever did this. Because holding on to hate, it just deepens the pain. The clip went viral. People flooded the station's social media with messages of support. Justice for Ryan trended on local platforms. Karina's own Instagram gained over 40,000 new followers in a week. But some people saw through the act. Inconsistencies. Detective Luis Moreno had been on the force for over a decade. Homicides weren't common in their district, and ones like this were practically unheard of. The first red flag? Karina's timeline. She claimed she had just returned from a book reading event in downtown Charleston. According to her, she left the venue at 10:15 p.m. and arrived home around 11:30 p.m., only to find Ryan already dead. But when Moreno requested her phone's GPS data, the timeline didn't add up. At 9:50 p.m., Karina's phone pinged off a cell tower less than a mile from their house. Between 9:50 and 10:15 p.m., her location remained stationary, right in her own driveway. A neighbor added fuel to the fire. Mrs. Delgado, who lived across the street, told police she saw Karina's white Audi SUV pull into the driveway just before 10 p.m. "I remember because my dog started barking," she said, "and Karina always waves when she pulls in." She didn't that night. So why was Karina lying? And more importantly, why had Ryan been killed while she was supposedly away? The smart lock. Investigators reviewed footage from the Cooper's Ring doorbell camera. The footage was strange, nothing between 8:45 p.m. and the time officers arrived, almost as if the system had been disabled. Turns out it had. The smart lock system, integrated with their home security, showed that someone had manually disarmed both the alarm and camera feeds at exactly 10:07 p.m. The disarm signal came from Karina's registered account, using her phone's biometric ID. Karina told detectives she never accessed the system that night, claimed her phone was in her purse the whole time, unused. But Moreno didn't believe her, and now he had a digital breadcrumb that placed her at the scene, long before she called for help. The financial trail. Karina's social image was flawless, but her finances were not. Ryan's sister, Hannah Cooper, told police that Ryan had recently discovered something troubling. He'd mentioned to her, just 10 days before his death, that he suspected Karina of mismanaging funds from their nonprofit, Books for Tomorrow, a charity Karina started for underprivileged children. "He thought she was pocketing some of the money," Hannah said. "He said he was going to confront her about it." Detectives subpoenaed the charity's bank records. What they found raised red flags. Over $42,000 in undocumented expenses had been transferred from the charity account to Karina's personal business, a self-publishing venture. But the most damning detail came from Ryan's will. He had updated it 3 weeks before his death, removing his brother as a secondary beneficiary and giving Karina full control over his estate, valued at over $2.4 million. The update came 1 week after Ryan and Karina had attended a marriage counseling session. The affair. Investigators followed a second trail, Karina's texts. She had exchanged over 200 messages with a man named Devin Mars, a well-known motivational speaker and author of a best-selling book on emotional self-mastery. He was charismatic, wealthy, and married. Their texts ranged from flirtatious to explicit. In one message, just 3 days before Ryan's murder, Devin wrote, "You deserve to be free. He's holding you back. You deserve everything." Karina replied, "Soon. Just a little longer. I'm almost there." Detectives couldn't tie Devin directly to the murder. He had a rock-solid alibi, but his involvement painted a different picture of Karina. She wasn't a heartbroken widow. She was a woman who felt trapped, wanted out, and had the means, and possibly the motive, to do something about it. A face of grief. In the following days, Karina doubled down on her public grief. She launched a fundraiser for Ryan's legacy, raising over $70,000 in 2 weeks. She released a limited edition children's book titled The Bravest Goodbye, claiming it was inspired by Ryan's final letter to her, though no such letter was ever found. She went on a second television interview. This time, she spoke about forgiveness. "Pain teaches us who we really are," she said, voice trembling, "and I choose to be someone who turns pain into purpose." But behind the scenes, investigators were preparing a case. They had the timeline, they had the tech data, they had motive, money, and digital evidence. What they didn't have, yet, was a confession. Karina's story was unraveling. The public still saw a grieving wife. But detectives saw something far more dangerous. A woman who used sympathy as a shield. A widow who used her words to control the narrative. A killer, hidden in plain sight. Chapter 2. Truth, Inconsistencies and Lies on Camera. The public had embraced her. Talk shows were calling her the strong widow, a voice for women dealing with sudden loss. Online commenters compared her to Maya Angelou, quoting her soft-spoken grief. Her podcast, Widow's Words, climbed into the top 30 on Apple's mental health chart just 10 days after launch. But inside Charleston's homicide unit, there was a very different sentiment brewing. Detective Luis Moreno stared at the evidence board in his office, photos of Ryan's body, a screenshot of Karina's Instagram post with the caption, "He gave me forever in just 7 years," and the smart lock timestamp, 10:07 p.m. Everything was off. And the deeper they looked, the more Karina's words betrayed her. The second interview. On March 19th, just 7 days after Ryan's death, Karina made her second televised appearance. This time, it was national. CNN's Midday Perspective brought her in for an exclusive sit-down. She wore white, understated makeup, a delicate gold necklace with Ryan's initials. But it was what she said that sent chills through the detectives watching back in Charleston. When asked what she saw when she entered the garage, she replied, "I opened the side door and saw the back of his head. That was all I could process at first. There was blood, and the way he was slumped, it was just wrong. The back of his head." That was the detail. Police had never publicly released the location of the gunshot wounds. Only someone at the crime scene, before investigators arrived, could have known that Ryan was shot behind the ear. This was the slip, small but significant. The digital double life. Detectives returned to Karina's phone. With a court-ordered digital forensics team, they recovered deleted texts, search history, and app data. What they found reframed everything. At 9:39 p.m. on the night of the murder, Karina searched how to silence motion sensors manually. At 9:44 p.m., she used her smart lock app to disable both the alarm and internal camera system. At 9:48 p.m., she opened the Voice Memos app and began a 6-minute recording. The file was named Just in Case. The audio was chilling. She spoke calmly, as if rehearsing. "I'm coming home from the event now. I have no idea what I'll find. If anything happens to Ryan, I wasn't here." The recording timestamp was 30 minutes before the 911 call. Detectives now had something rare, a manufactured alibi, pre-recorded, premeditated, and documented. The man behind the mic. The name Devin Mars came up again and again. Detectives dug into Devin's background. Polished, charismatic, and deeply influential in the self-help space, he'd built a brand around emotional resilience and cutting ties with toxicity. His fan base, primarily women in difficult marriages or emotional distress, treated him like a prophet. Karina wasn't just a fan, she was a repeat guest at his retreats. Emails between them suggested a growing intimacy. Devin's team denied a romantic relationship, but a Venmo payment from Karina to Devin, labeled "Our Secret Getaway," told a different story, even more telling with the voice notes. "Karina, he thinks I'm stupid. He doesn't know I'm 4 steps ahead. I'm not staying in this cage." Devin, "Then stop letting him hold the key." Though nothing directly implicated Devin in the murder, the psychological dynamic between them was clear. Karina wanted Ryan out of her life, and Devin encouraged her to take control, no matter the cost. Podcast or propaganda? On March 18th, just 6 days after Ryan's murder, Karina launched her podcast, Widow's Words. Episode 1, Grace Under Fire. Episode 2, The Night I Lost Everything. Episode 3, Healing Isn't Linear. But what started as a grief journey turned into a digital confession. In episode 2, Karina said, "Sometimes I wonder if he knew it was coming. The way he looked at me that day, like he wanted to say something, but didn't. Maybe he could feel the energy shifting." Again, this wasn't a woman in shock. It was someone narrating their own crime story, with subtle flair. Detective Moreno noted 3 details she repeated. The back of his head. Again. There was no sign of forced entry. Not public knowledge. I didn't hear a thing. It was already quiet. The way she said already suggested she had expected it, prepared for it. Moreno called it emotional choreography, a performance designed to control how the public processed the narrative, down to the tone, the tempo, the pauses. She wasn't grieving, he told a colleague. She was directing. The Foundation Falls. Karina's charity, Books for Tomorrow, was once lauded for its outreach in low-income schools, but the financial records told a different story. Nearly 60% of donations were redirected to Karina's private LLC, a company that didn't publish books, but hosted spiritual empowerment workshops. She listed these as creative retreats on tax forms, including one held in Turks and Caicos, where Devon Mars was a guest speaker. Ryan had confronted her about this in an email dated February 28th. We need to talk. I'm going to the board. This isn't just unethical. It's illegal. I won't be a part of this. Karina never replied to that email, but she forwarded it to herself and added a note at the top. He's turning on me. It was the first entry in a folder titled Insurance. The Red Journal. The break in the case came from a search of Karina's home office. While scanning drawers and bookshelves, an officer found a locked compartment in the bottom of Karina's custom-built writing desk. Inside was a red leather-bound journal. Detectives hoped for clues. What they found was a window into a calculated mind. The journal chronicled her emotional descent over 14 months, but not in the way victims do. It wasn't confessional. It was strategic. He's watching everything now, even my phone. I need to start prepping an alibi. If I just vanish, he wins. But if he's gone, it's clean. No divorce, no scandal, just grief. Public pain earns privacy. The camera will shield me. In the margin of one entry, she scribbled, "No weapon equals no time." This was damning, not just premeditation, documented intent. The public turns. Once the journal was admitted into evidence under a sealed warrant, the tone shifted. Karina's fan base fractured. Supporters turned skeptical. News outlets that had praised her now aired segments titled Performance or Psychosis. A true crime podcast host tweeted, "She built a platform on pain, but someone else had to die for her spotlight." Karina's response. She released episode 4 of her podcast, When They Turn on You. In it, she blamed the media, claimed the journal was fiction, said her phone was hacked, called the investigation a witch hunt. But the performance was cracking, and the audience was no longer buying the show. Setting the stage for trial. On April 3rd, just 3 weeks after the murder, Karina was formally charged with first-degree murder, obstruction of justice, wire fraud, misappropriation of charitable funds. The arrest was televised live. Karina, in a pale blue blouse, handcuffed, walked calmly to the cruiser. A crowd had gathered. Some shouted, "Murderer!" Others simply stared in stunned silence. Ryan's sister Hannah stood nearby, holding a framed photo of her brother. In a tearful press conference later that day, she said, "Ryan wasn't just killed. He was erased from his own story, and the person doing the erasing wore his wedding ring." Karina's words, her crafted narrative, her social media, her podcast, had once earned sympathy. Now they were evidence, and the trial would prove one thing beyond doubt. She used the truth like a scalpel, slicing only what she wanted you to see. Chapter 3. Widow's Words Turned Weapon. The courtroom was silent as the jury entered. Karina Cooper stood in tailored navy blue, hair neatly pulled back, lips set in the same soft, solemn smile she had worn through every public appearance since Ryan's death. Her posture was perfect. Her eyes scanned the gallery with a subtle flick, acknowledging supporters, press, and detractors all at once. But this wasn't a press junket. This was a murder trial. The people of South Carolina versus Karina Elise Cooper, and the prosecution had come loaded, not with speculation or character smears, but with Karina's own words. The widow, it turned out, had written her own indictment. opening statements. Prosecutor Dana Whitfield didn't open with the security footage or the smart lock data. She opened with Karina's podcast. The defendant, she told the jury, wanted to be seen. She wanted control. And she believed that if she shaped the story fast enough, loud enough, and beautifully enough, no one would question her version of the truth. She paused, looked directly at Karina. But the truth has its own gravity. The defense, led by Martin Leclerc, painted a different picture. A grieving woman misunderstood by a judgmental society. Karina used her voice to survive, he said. Not to deceive. But it was what came next that no one expected. The widow on the stand. It's rare for a defendant in a murder trial to testify. Most are warned against it. But Karina insisted. She took the stand on the fifth day of the trial, confident, prepared. For hours, her attorney guided her through her life, her marriage, and the night of Ryan's murder. She cried, just enough. She quoted scriptures. She described her podcast as a lifeline. The courtroom was transfixed. But then the cross-examination began. Whitfield stood calmly, holding Karina's red journal. "Miss Cooper," she said, "can you confirm this is your journal?" Karina nodded. "Yes." "Did you write the following?" She read, "If I just vanish, he wins. But if he's gone, it's clean." Karina hesitated. That entry was fiction. "I use journaling as a form of therapeutic storytelling." Whitfield raised an eyebrow. "Fiction?" "Yes, a writing exercise." "So you imagined murdering your husband in a fictional character's voice?" Silence. Then Whitfield held up a printed transcript of episode 2 of Widow's Words. "I opened the door and saw the back of his head." "That detail was never made public," Whitfield said. "How did you know the wound location, Miss Cooper?" Karina looked to the jury, then back at Whitfield. "I assumed." "You assumed correctly?" "Twice, in 2 separate interviews. And in your podcast?" Karina's mouth opened, but no words came out. The slip. The final nail didn't come from a camera or a text. It came from a recording recovered from Karina's podcast equipment, one she hadn't released publicly. Episode 5. The moment everything broke. It was incomplete. A rehearsal. She stuttered, rewound, re-recorded. But in the raw cut, she said something that never made it into the final version. "It's like he knew I'd come home early, like he expected me. And when he didn't fight back, I mean when I saw him there, I froze. I mean, 2 seconds, but it was enough." Prosecutor Whitfield played the clip in full, twice. The courtroom was stone silent. The audio engineer testified that the clip had a creation timestamp of 7:12 a.m. on March 13th, barely 7 hours after Ryan's death. Karina had recorded it before the police interview, before the autopsy, before the details were known. She'd slipped. She'd confessed. If only for a moment, when she believed no one else would ever hear it. Verdict. The jury deliberated for just under 6 hours. Karina Cooper was found guilty on all counts: first-degree murder, obstruction of justice, insurance fraud, misuse of charitable funds. When the foreman read the verdict, Karina blinked slowly, then bowed her head, not in shame, but like an actor exiting stage left. Sentencing followed a week later, life without parole. The judge, in his remarks, said, "You used language as your weapon, performance as your shield, and the public's sympathy as your stage. This court isn't punishing a woman who lost her husband. It's convicting a woman who killed him and then tried to rewrite the ending." Aftermath. The fallout was swift. Karina's podcast was pulled from all major platforms. Her books were quietly removed from shelves. The Books for Tomorrow Foundation dissolved within weeks. But public fascination didn't fade. The case became a national obsession. Not just for its crime, but for its commentary on modern grief culture, curated tragedy, and performative empathy. A Netflix documentary followed. A best-selling book, Narrative Control, The Karina Cooper Case, spent 18 weeks on the NYT list, Podcast hosts debated whether Karina was a narcissist, a sociopath, or simply a woman who couldn't handle being forgotten. But for Ryan Cooper's family, there was only one truth. He was a kind man, a loyal husband, a man who trusted someone who used his trust against him. His sister Hannah said it best at his memorial. Karina didn't just murder my brother, she erased him. She turned him into a plot device in her own twisted script. But today, we reclaim his story. Final note. True crime often gives us monsters, but sometimes it gives us mirrors. Karina Cooper's case isn't just about murder, it's about manipulation in its most modern form. Curated, branded, and algorithmically enhanced. She didn't need a weapon. She had words. And for a time, they were more powerful than any gun, but not more powerful than the truth.